In the summing up of a paper, Tipping the Iceberg, the State of the Arts and Health in Canada, Susan Cox describes the unstoppable momentum wherein new work will surface, new practitioners will emerge, and new connections will be forged. Mike White rather poetically describes this arts and health movement as a small-scale global phenomenon. I want to explore the idea of us being some kind of phenomenon, but ask, if we're a kind of cultural supernova, don't we run the risk of burning brightly for the blink of an eye, only to fade rapidly into obscurity? A supernova is an exploding star that's reached the end of its life and can briefly outshine entire galaxies, radiating more energy than our sun will in its entire lifetime. The Olympic and Paralympic Games in London might usefully illustrate what I mean by a cultural supernova, particularly around the bravado of the Paralympics having, as Lord Coe described it, a seismic effect in shifting public attitudes, commenting, "I don't think the public will ever see disability in the same way again." His optimism is admirable, but like the extraordinary pyrotechnical opening ceremony, its long-term impact remains to be seen. I want to plot something of our shared journey to this moment in time and think about our evolution. What can we learn from the past to inform our unstoppable momentum? And as a starting point, it's useful for me to think about the language we use in terms of the arts and of public health. The social determinants of health are the conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work and age. Circumstances that are shaped by the distribution of money, of power and resources at a global, national and at local levels. These are mostly responsible for health inequalities. I'd like to begin by thinking about this thing we call the Enlightenment, where 18th century advances in science and critical thinking created a shift in the way people saw the world, moving towards reason and rationality over superstition, tradition and faith. Imagine a period of such rapid change, of transforming ideologies. Spinoza questioning the age-old belief that body and mind were two separate substances. Isaac Newton in his book, The Principia, writing one of the most important scientific books ever written and setting out what's still seen as the gold standard in scientific writing. And if you forgive me, I'd like you to imagine it's 1730 and we're in the hall of a great country house in the wildest, remotest countryside of rural England. Isaac Newton's recently died and science is coming into its own. In this hall are gathered the great and good of the day in their finery. Imagine the wind howling through the trees, and in this hall, fellows of the Royal Society are gathered to witness a revelation in physics. The scientist, Stephen Gray, is at the centre of the throng, and above him, suspended in the shadows of the darkened ceiling, hung on silken threads, is a small, pale boy, collected that day from a charity school for the purpose of scientific experimentation of the most spectacular kind, an experiment in electricity. The boy's feet were connected to a friction generator, and as he dangled in front of the captivated guests, electricity was generated and the child began to attract small pieces of paper that fluttered through the air towards his positively charged body, face and hands. This simple experiment, known as the flying boy, spawned a culture of scientific showmanship from which we would begin to believe that we could develop the ability to understand the natural world and the power to control it. This period of experimentation saw science evolving at a rapid pace, and like any innovation that challenged the norms of the time, material electricity was seen as a threat to the known world, where devotion was turning away from God and towards electricity. In cultural terms, it would be almost another 70 years before Mary Shelley, so excited by the possibilities of science, illustrated this heretical belief through her creation myth for the science age, Frankenstein. And over this very same enlightened period, seafaring Europeans were out there discovering new worlds, subjugating indigenous populations, and beginning the long, slow process of what we now call globalisation, the dominance of one particular worldview. So the Enlightenment stretched on through the 18th century with science and engineering impacting on all areas of life. New technologies and the Industrial Revolution in turn had a profound effect on society. The inevitable cramped and unsanitary living conditions of the workers during this great period of flux led to the deaths of tens of thousands of people from diseases like cholera. And in 1842, Edwin Chadwick was commissioned to investigate the sanitary conditions of the impoverished labouring population of Great Britain. These were some of the first seeds of what we now describe as public health. When Charles Edward Winslow defined public health in 1920, he referred to the science and art of preventing disease, of education, of social machinery, and realising birthrights, all things that require knowledge, imagination, and political advocacy. I'd like to take a leap of faith, and with those ideas of early public health in mind, think about the participatory arts in these terms. And throughout this paper, I'm going to draw upon two essays, one by Tim Lang and Jeff Rayner in the British Medical Journal, and the other by Sandra Carlisle and colleagues in Perspectives in Public Health Journal. Carlisle suggests that the influence of science has expanded enormously, reaping huge benefits across much of life, not least medicine. She argues, however, that faith in science has morphed into an ideology best called scientism. Under scientism, what really matters is that which can be supported by evidence, can be counted and measured, and above all, can be shown to be value for money. Concerns about evidence and value for money are important, but can cause problems when taken too far, particularly, she notes, if metrics are used as the sole measure of success. Carlisle believes that modern life is in decline because its methods and mindset are increasingly recognised as unsustainable. She argues that those interested in public health will need to develop new ways of thinking, being and doing, and new forms of understanding the world to help us learn our way into the future. She suggests we've become increasingly separated from nature, and this has led to an ecological crisis. We're separated from each other, and that creates conflict and damaging forms of individualism and selfishness. And we're separated from ourselves, and that we tend not to be in touch with our own sense of purpose. Similarly, Lang and Rayner believe that the pursuit of health and progress have become tangled up with consumerism, as though there are no environmental consequences for health. They ask, how can we reframe thinking about mental health, social exclusion and inequalities, without placing democracy at the heart of our thinking, where people have a sense of and actual engagement in shaping society and life, particularly when we live in a world in which so many people are excluded from control? They argue that this is the mass psychological impact of modern advertising and the media that requires urgent action in the name of health. These authors suggest we're apportioning blame on the individual, and when we focus on the micro, we fail to see the big picture or the shaping forces that frame the way we live our lives. They believe that our capacity to think and plan on a large scale is given over to corporations, world elites, and the dehumanised forces of the market. We're told that globalisation is an inevitable consequence of modern life, as though that the process itself wasn't initiated by the vested interests of those who too rarely consider health impacts. In 2011, the World Health Organization Rio Political Declaration on Social Determinants of Health stressed the commitments of member states to take action in a number of priority areas. And for the cultural sector, two action points are of particular relevance: promoting participation in policy making and reorienting the health sector towards promoting health and reducing health inequalities. Relatively invisible from the high-end policy world of the World Health Organization, the arts will need to describe their potency in the most compelling ways. Our conversation needs to be about extending knowledge, partnerships and awareness on a global scale, but that allows for work around the social determinants of health to be culturally relevant, equitable and geographically specific, and not some arts and health one-size-fits-all foreign policy. If we're to place culture and the arts at the centre of public health, we need to be confident about our offer. There is a danger, however, that when policymakers show any interest in a field like arts and health, that it's potentially short-lived, particularly if it's during a period of government elections. So how is it that in the middle of all the global recession, it seems that the arts and health agenda is evolving and is coming into its own? Throughout arts and health development, there have been luminaries and champions, people who see the potential for the arts beyond artificial domains. In the UK, no one better illustrates this in terms of political advocacy than Lord Howarth of Newport. One-time Minister for the Arts, Howarth has embraced the arts as a vehicle for health and social change and has initiated debates in the House of Lords on three separate occasions. He's currently engaged with politicians of different political colours in cross-party commitment to further nurturing the arts and health agenda at the highest level. Commenting on the Manifesto for Arts, Health and Wellbeing that I shared with the conference last year, Howarth speaks lyrically about the nature of arts and public health. I'll quote him in full. "What is at issue is the right each one of us has to be human. To be human is to identify and liberate our own authentic and best nature. That quest will sometimes be private and sometimes be communal, and in the end, the one merges into the other as we make the world we inhabit a better place. Trust, arduousness, risk, self-expression, shared work are a means of moving towards individual and collective integrity. Teaching and companionship sustain us. Orthodoxy and exploitation blight us. Politics should be predicated on these values." Following the collapse of the National Network for Arts and Health and seeing the need for a national conversation, the London Arts and Health Forum have coordinated a regional network champions across England to come together as National Alliance for Arts, Health and Wellbeing, whose purpose is to galvanise grassroots engagement across the sector. Building on the manifesto, the regional partners have developed a national charter for arts, health and wellbeing through stakeholder events across England. Seen alongside the Emerging Arts and Health Research Network and the planned Culture, Health and Wellbeing International Conference in Bristol in 2013, the field in England certainly seems to be flourishing. In the United States, the Society for Arts in Healthcare have rebranded themselves as the Global Alliance for Arts and Health. And whilst concerns around globalism and issues of local identity and cultural distinctiveness are growing, this is an intriguing development. In 2009, and with World Health Organization support, the first international Latin American Arts Health Forum took place in Peru, where partners developed their visionary statement, the Lima Declaration on Arts and Health and Development. And this network embraces Latin American countries with a driving vision that the arts are a powerful force for social change. It would be really interesting to see how both Asian and African countries develop their own distinct networks too. And annual conferences like this, organised by Arts and Health Australia, seen alongside the emergent National Framework for Arts and Health in Australia, are building on what appears to be the genuine commitment of leading government ministers interested in developing innovative ways of tackling inequalities. Similarly, high-level ministerial support is evident in Wales with its National Arts, Health and Wellbeing Action Plan, and in France, Musique et Santé have a long-term interministerial concordat between the Ministries for Culture and the Ministries for Health. In Europe, Lithuania has made steady incremental developments within arts and health. Led by the Lithuanian Artists Association, who initiated a discussion in Parliament in 2009, that has the President and Prime Minister's advocacy, they've influenced Lithuanian cultural policy towards the arts and health, which has now been refined into an action research project. This stepped approach displays sophistication and integrity. In Europe, there are a number of networks, but Finland really stands out. And through their quiet, methodological work that echoes World Health Organization priorities, they've embraced arts and culture as a fundamental human right that should be available to everyone throughout their lives. The 5-year action programme, Art and Culture for Wellbeing, offers a manifesto and a vision that not only suggests an achievable and succinct action plan, but offers a shrewd mechanism for delivery. After conducting a review of the field in 2008, 17 organisations began working together to deliver a plan, which includes ministries of education, culture, social affairs, health, employment and the environment. It includes regional and local authorities, arts councils, academia, the third sector and the private sector. And critically, this influential group of organisation is chaired by the Assistant Director General of the National Institute for Health and Welfare. For me, one of the most important elements of their work is that it starts with three things they assert are known. Health and well-being can be promoted by means of art and culture. Art and culture can enhance inclusion at the individual, community and societal levels, and everybody should have the right to participate in and enjoy the cultural life of the community. They acknowledge that health and well-being and art and culture have been kept separate at policy level and with limited coordination between the sectors, and that good practice exists is often tied to short-term projects. But they're working to bridge the political, administrative and structural together. So here we have a realistic and achievable arts and health manifesto that's led by a senior figure within the health system and that has the input of key ministerial departments alongside the cultural, voluntary and private sectors. Funded in part by the public purse and partly by the private sector, and with no government elections until 2015, when it comes to policy and practice, it perhaps might be more interesting to follow both Finnish and South American developments and think of this arts and health field stretching way beyond the comfortable confines of English-speaking countries. What's particularly impressive about the Finnish manifesto is the way that they describe the work and the assumptions and belief of both what's known and what's expected. And they do it with Dickensian vision. In one of their presentation slides, it's titled Great Expectations, and it describes how they want to see the field within the next period of time. And I'll just tell you some of these expectations. The significance of the positive effect of art and culture on well-being is understood on all administrative and policy levels. Art and culture-based methods are actively used as part of preventative measures. The importance of cultural activities is increasing. Inclusion and social capital is understood. Effects of the built environment are seen as part of overall well-being. And finally, culture is seen as part of promoting well-being in the workplace. This is neat. It's got ambition, but it isn't beyond the realms of imagination. It brings my essay full circle into the idea of a writer like Charles Dickens producing Great Expectations, illuminating the inequalities of industrialised Victorian Britain, a coming-of-age story where the protagonist achieves maturity incrementally and with some difficulty, often at odds with society. There's something of an arts and health theme here, and I'll return to this theme in a moment. It would be easy to make the mistake and think that the arts and health agenda is simple instrumentalism, reducing culture and the arts to a subservient tool for well-meaning social engineers. But the Royal Society of the Arts usefully unpick what could be described as a spectrum that spans artistic instrumentalism and public good instrumentalism. They argue the case for re-evaluating ingrained cultural bigotry at both ends of the spectrum, suggesting a different possibility, making a robust instrumental case for arts funding, but in terms that recognise what's different and special about artistic participation and appreciation. As Hasan Bakshi usefully notes in his essay, Beauty, Value Beyond Measure, even the authors of the UK Government's Treasury's Green Book Guidelines for Cost-Benefit Analysis recommend that a range of techniques be used to elicit non-market values, even if these are subjective. The Royal Society of the Arts make a compelling case for methodologies that place the public at the heart of decision-making through the estimating of the intrinsic value of the arts. Describing what François Matarazzo has called distributed culture, they suggest that the public should be enabled to directly commission art and cultural activity. This is a model in which local communities are given public money to invest in a local cultural production, supporting a cultural programme of their own choosing. The result might be that cultural organisations, large and small, would be competing to tender to create vibrant cultural programmes for communities, and thus all the parties would be have a greater understanding of the value and the process of the product. Lang and Rayner suggest that public health needs to build its knowledge, pursuing continual intellectual engagement, meaning more than just gathering evidence, but the open pursuit of social values, including the role of interest groups, and debate across society, but that's not just within restricted scientific circles. This is big thinking about the very nature of our lives. They suggest that public health requires action on multiple fronts and embraces the argument familiar to the 19th century, that public health action requires a public health movement and a reimagining of how we engage with people. In her critique of the influential Marmot Review on Inequalities, Kate Pickett notes that Marmot just restates similar inequalities that were exposed in the early 1980s, and what's missing is the political courage to deal with the root causes of the social determinants. Why people smoke rather than just trying to get them to stop. Why people eat too much, commit violence, trust each other less, rather than trying to understand the social inequalities that stand in their way. The coming-of-age story that we're telling is at a critical stage. We're beginning to articulate what it is we do more effectively, and we're starting to influence policy and wider public understanding. But I can see a parallel between the fear and excitement generated by those early experiments in electricity and where we are today, all excited soundbites and quick-hit projects. If policymakers seem to be listening and consulting with their citizens in the face of ongoing civic unrest, will an unformulated response from the arts and public health sector explode in the blink of an eye and be forgotten in an instant? Are we ready to articulate our vision and coordinate our resources? Science is a beautiful thing, constantly challenging our ideas and pushing boundaries. And recounting early stories of electricity and small glowing children is relevant today. Those early experimentalists and artists like Mary Shelley responded to their times and imagined other possibilities. Could they have imagined the potential of the Large Hadron Collider, the possibility of cloning, or predict the consequences of globalisation on the environment? How do we, in turn, imagine our work in the context of the new pandemics of obesity and addictive behaviour? Whilst the Paralympic and Olympic Games roused and excited our emotions, our delusion that disability will never be seen in the same way again must be tempered by the knowledge that reported hate crimes against people with disabilities in the UK rose by a third between 2010 and 2012. And whilst the Paralympians inspired us to the potential of human capability, it can easily be argued that the Games symbolised the world of contrast between the superfit elite and the overweight public, with sponsors Dow, McDonald's, BP and Coca-Cola, amongst others, mediating our stupefied relationship with physical activity and celebrity hero worship. Brazil is reportedly the sixth richest economy in the world, and in 2016 it will host the Olympic and Paralympic Games, yet arguably its inequalities are endemic, and its burgeoning environmental issues, particularly through deforestation of the Amazon, are of pressing concern. However, Latin America's rich with cultural activity and a groundswell of innovative public health enterprise. What place will the arts have in telling this story and influencing change beyond the opening pyrotechnics? I'd argue that the reach and longevity of organisations like Dada says more about the status it gives to marginalised people than the Olympics ever will. In terms of our planet's evolution, humans have only been around for the blink of an eye, and we're very much at an early stage in our progress. Do we have the power to control nature? We may think we do as we exfoliate the land for our short-term needs, but if we are part of a 21st century enlightenment, we need to understand human well-being in relation to wider societal issues. Lang and Rayner tell us that public health success is as much about imagination as evidence, challenging what's accepted as the so-called norm. Public health must regain the capacity and the will to address complexity and dare to confront power. I think if we're prepared to look outside our gated community of arts and health and venture into the world of non-English speaking countries or engage with people who don't think they've got a voice, we'd be exposed to communities who are very much pursuing the same goals as us. By moving away from a focus on the sick individual towards community engagement and environmental health, we open up new ways of learning ourselves into the future, contributing to new and evolving collaborations that take into account our pasts, but imagine new and very different futures. The idea of the arts and health movement being some kind of cultural supernova sounds poetic, but in truth it's the potency of all these groups, projects and individuals who are part of some incredibly rich, small-scale global phenomenon that doesn't quite yet know that it's being born.